Our classes, of course, lasted more than 5 hours a day, but this particular session, the afternoon session, lasted 5 hours. The hours dragged by, it seemed that we had been in that classroom for days. The shadows seemed scarcely to move and the sun overhead seemed as if rooted to one spot. We sighed in exasperation and with boredom, we felt that one of the gods should come down and remove this particular teacher from our midst, for he was the worst of them all, apparently forgetting that once, oh, so long ago, he too had been young. But at last, the conches sounded, and high above us on the roof a trumpet blared forth echoing across the valley, sending an echo back from the Potala. With a sigh the teacher said, "Well, I am afraid that I have to let you boys go now, but believe me when I see you again I shall make sure that you have learned something." He gave a sign and motioned toward the door. The boys in the row nearest jumped to their feet and really bolted for it. I was just going as well but he called me back. "You, Tuesday Lobsang Rampa," he said, "you go away to your guide and you learn things, but don't come back here showing up the boys that I have taught. You are being taught by hypnotism and other methods. I am going to see if I cannot get you kicked out." He gave me a cuff to the side of the head, and continued, "Now get out of my sight. I hate the sight of you here. Other people are complaining that you are learning more than the boys whom I teach." As soon as he let go of my collar I bolted too and did not even bother to shut the door behind me. He bawled out something but I was traveling too fast to go back. Outside some of the other boys were waiting, well out of earshot of the teacher of course. "We ought to do something about that one," said one boy. "Yes," said another, "somebody is going to get really hurt if he goes on unchecked like that." "You, Lobsang," said a third boy, "you are always boasting about your teacher and guide. Why don't you say something about the way we are ill-treated?" I thought about it, and it seemed to me to be a good idea, for we had to learn but there was no reason why we should be taught with such brutality. The more I thought about it the more pleasant it seemed. I would go to my guide and tell him how we were treated, and he would go down and put a spell on this teacher and turn him into a toad or something like that. "Yes," I exclaimed, "I will go now." With that I turned and ran off. I hastened along the familiar corridors, ascending up and so that I got nearer the roof. At last I turned into the lama's corridor and found that my guide was already in his room with the door open. He bade me enter and said, "Why, Lobsang, you are in a state of excitement. Have you been made an abbot or something?" I looked at him rather ruefully, and said, "Honorable lama, why are we boys so ill-treated in class?" My guide looked at me quite seriously and said, "But how have you been treated badly, Lobsang? Sit down and tell me what it is that is worrying you so much." I sat down, and commenced my sad recital. During the time I was speaking my guide made no comment, made no interruption whatever. He allowed me my say, and at last reached the end of my tale of woe and almost the end of my breath. "Lobsang," said my guide, "does it occur to you that life itself is just a school?" "A school?" I looked at him as if he had suddenly taken leave of his senses. I could not have been more surprised if he had told me that the sun had retired and the moon had taken over. "Honorable Lama," I said in astonishment, "did you say that life was a school?" "Most certainly I did, Lobsang. Rest a while, let us have tea, and then we will talk." The attendant who was summoned soon brought us tea and enjoyable things to eat. My guide partook of food very sparingly indeed. As he once said, "I ate enough to keep about 4 of him." But he said it with such a twinkling smile that there was no offense implied or taken. He often teased me and I knew that he would never under any consideration say anything that would hurt another person. I really did not mind in the least what he said to me, knowing how well he meant it. We sat and had our tea, and then my guide wrote a little note and gave it to the attendant to deliver to another lama. "Lobsang, I have said that you and I will not be at temple service this evening, for we have much to discuss, and although temple services are very essential things so, in view of your special circumstances, is it necessary to give you more tuition than average?" He rose to his feet and walked across to the window. I scrambled to my feet too and went across to join him, for it was one of my pleasures to look out and see all that was happening, for my guide had one of the higher rooms at the Chakpurai, a room from which one could look out over wide spaces and see for long distances. Besides, he had that most enjoyable of all things, a telescope. The hours I spent with that instrument. The hours I spent looking away across the plain of Lhasa, looking at the traders in the city itself, and watching the ladies of Lhasa going about their business, shopping, visiting, and just, as I put it, plain wasting time. For 10 or 15 minutes we stood there looking out, then my guide said, "Let us sit down again, Lobsang, and discuss this matter about a school, shall we? I want you to listen to me, Lobsang, for this is a matter which you should have clear from the start. If you do not fully understand what I say, then stop me immediately, for it is essential that you understand all this, you hear?" I nodded to him, and then as a matter of politeness said, "Yes, Honorable Lama, I hear you and I understand. If I do not understand, I will tell you." He nodded and said, "Life is like a school. When we are beyond this life in the astral world, before we come down into a woman's body, we discuss with others what we are going to learn. Some time ago I told you a story about Old Seng, the Chinaman. I told you that we would use a Chinese name because you, being you, would try to associate any Tibetan name with a Tibetan of your acquaintance. Let us say that Old Seng, who died and saw all his past, decided that he had certain lessons to learn. Then, the people who were helping him would look about to find parents, or, rather, prospective parents, who were living in the circumstances and in the conditions which would enable the soul which had been Old Seng to learn the desired lessons." My guide looked at me and said, "It is much the same as a boy who is going to become a monk. If he wants to become a medical monk, he comes to the Chakpurai. If he wants to do perhaps domestic work, then no doubt he can get into the Potala, for they always seem to have a shortage of domestic monks there. We choose our school according to what we want to learn." I nodded, because that was quite clear to me. My own parents had made arrangements for me to get into the Chakpurai provided I had the necessary staying power to pass the initial test of endurance. My guide, the Lama Minyadon Up, continued, "A person who is going to be born already has everything arranged. The person is going to come down and be born of a certain woman who lives in a certain district and who is married to a certain class of man. It is thought that that will give the baby to be born the opportunities for gaining the experience and knowledge previously planned. Eventually, in the fullness of time, the baby is born. First the baby has to learn to feed. It has to learn how to control certain parts of its physical body. It has to learn how to speak and how to listen. At first, you know, a baby cannot focus its eyes. It has to learn how to see. It is at school." He looked at me and there was a smile on his face as he said, "None of us like school. Some of us have to come, but others of us do not have to come. We plan to come, not for karma, but to learn other things. The baby grows up and becomes a boy and then goes to a classroom where often he gets treated rather roughly by his teacher, but there is nothing wrong in that, Lobsang. No one has ever been harmed by discipline. Discipline is the difference between an army and a rabble. You cannot have a cultured man unless that man has been disciplined. Many times now you will think that you are ill-treated, that the teacher is harsh and cruel. But, whatever you think now, you particularly arranged to come to this earth in these conditions." "Well, Honorable Lama," I exclaimed excitedly, "if I arranged to come down here, then I think that I should have my brains examined. And if I arranged to come down here, why do I know nothing at all about it?" My guide looked at me and laughed, laughed outright. "I know just how you feel, Lobsang, today," he replied. "But really there is nothing that you should worry about. You came to this earth first to learn certain things. Then, having learned those certain things, you are going out into the greater world beyond our borders to learn other things. The way will not be easy, but you will succeed in the end, and I do not want you to be despondent. Every person, no matter his station in life, has come down to earth from the astral planes in order that he may learn and, in learning, progress. You will agree with me, Lobsang, that if you want to progress in the Lama's reuse study and pass examinations, you would not think much of a boy who was suddenly placed over you and by favoritism alone became a Lama or an abbot. So long as there are proper examinations, then you know that you are not being passed over at some superior person's whim or fancies or favoritisms. I could see that too, yes, when it was explained, it was quite a simple matter. We come to Earth to learn things, and no matter how hard nor how bitter the lessons which we learn on this Earth, they are lessons for which we have enrolled before we came here. When we leave this Earth, we have our vacation for a time in the other world, and then if we want to make progress, we move on. We may return to this Earth under different conditions, or we may move on to a completely different stage of existence. Often when we are in school, we think that there is going to be no end to the day, we think that there is going to be no end to the harshness of the teacher. Life on Earth is like that. If everything went smoothly for us, if we had everything that we wanted, we should not be learning a lesson, we should just be drifting along on the stream of life. It is a sad fact that we only learn with pain and suffering. Well then, Honorable Lama, I said, why is it that some boys, and some lamas too, have such an easy time? It always appears to me that I get hardships, bad prophecies, and beatings up by an irritable teacher when I really have done my best. But, Lobsang, some of these people who apparently are very self-satisfied, are you sure that they are so self-satisfied? Are you sure that conditions are so easy for them, after all? Until you know what they planned to do before they came to the Earth, you are not in a position to judge. Every person coming to this Earth comes with a prepared plan, a plan of what they want to learn, what they propose to do, and what they aspire to be when they leave this Earth after sojourning in its school. And you say that you tried really hard at class today. Are you sure? Were you not rather complacent, thinking that you knew all there was to know about the lesson? Did you not, by your rather superior attitude, make the teacher feel rather bad? He looked at me somewhat accusingly, and I felt my cheeks grow somewhat red. Yes, he really knew something. My guide had the most unhappy knack of putting his hand on a spot which was tender. Yes, I had been complacent. I had thought that this time the teacher would not be able to find the slightest fault with me. My own superior attitude had, of course, in no small measure contributed toward the exasperation of that teacher. I nodded in agreement. Yes, Honorable Lama, I am as much to blame as anyone. My guide looked at me, smiled, and nodded in approval. Later, Lobsang, you will be going to Chongqing in China, as you know, said the Lama Minya Dondup. I nodded, dumbly, not liking even to think of the time when I should have to leave. He continued, before you leave Tibet, we shall send to various colleges and universities for details about their instruction. We shall receive all particulars and we shall then decide which college or university will offer you exactly the type of training which you will need in this life. In a similar manner, before a person in the astral world even thinks of coming down to Earth, he weighs up what he proposes to do, what he wants to learn, and what he finally wants to achieve. Then, as I have already told you, suitable parents are discovered. That is the same as looking for a suitable school. The more I thought about this school idea, the more I disliked it. Honorable Lama, I said, why do some people have so much illness, so much misfortune? What does that teach them? My guide said, but you must remember that a person who comes down to this world has much to learn. It is not just a matter of learning to carve, not just a matter of learning a language or reciting from sacred books. The person has to learn things which are going to be of use in the astral world after leaving the Earth. As I have told you, this is the world of illusion, and it is extremely well suited to teach us hardship, and in suffering hardship, we should learn to understand the difficulties and the problems of others. I thought about all this, and it seemed that we had got onto a very big subject. My guide obviously got my thoughts, for he said, yes, the night is coming upon us. It is time to end our discussion for this night, for we have much to do yet. I have to go across to the peak, as we call the Potala, and I want to take you with me. You will be there all night and all tomorrow. Tomorrow we can discuss this matter again, but go now and put on a clean robe and bring a spare with you. He rose to his feet and left the room. I hesitated but for a moment, and that because I was in a daze. And then I hurried off to array myself in my best, and to get my second best as my spare. Together we jogged down the mountain road and into the Manuakhang. Just as we passed the Pagotling, or Western Gate, there was a sudden loud squall behind me that almost lifted me from my saddle. "Ow! Holy Medical Lama!" yelled a feminine voice just to the side of the road. My guide looked about him, and dismounted. Knowing my own uncertainties on a pony, he motioned for me to remain seated, a concession which filled me with gratitude. "Yes, madame, what is it?" asked my guide in kind tones. There was a sudden blur of movement, and a woman flung herself to the ground at his feet. "Oh, Holy Medical Lama," she said breathlessly, "my husband could not beget a normal son, the misbegotten son of a she-goat." Dumbly, stunned at her own audacity, she held out a small bundle. My guide stooped down from his great height and looked. "But, madame," he remarked, "why do you blame your husband for your ailing child?" "Because that ill-favored man was always running around with loose women. All he thinks about is the opposite sex, and then when we get married he cannot even father a normal child." To my dismay she started weeping and her tears ran down to hit the ground with little plops, just like hailstones, I thought, coming down from the mountains. My guide looked about him, peering somewhat in the increasing darkness. A figure by the side of the Pagotling detached himself from the darker shadows and moved forward, a man in a ragged dress and wearing a definitely hangdog expression. My guide beckoned to him and he came forward, and knelt on the ground at the feet of the Lama Miniadondup. My guide looked at both of them and said, "You do not right to blame each other for a mishap at birth, for this is not a matter which occurred between you, but is a matter to do with karma." He looked at the child again, pulling aside the wrappings in which the baby was swaddled. He looked hard, and I knew that he was looking at the infant Sora. Then he stood up saying, "Madame, your child can be cured. His cure is well within our abilities. Why did you not bring him to us earlier?" The poor woman dropped to her knees again, and hastily passed the child to her husband, who took it as if it might explode at any moment. The woman clasped her hands, and looking at my guide said, "Holy Medical Lama, who would pay attention to us, for we come from the Regyab and we are not in favor with some of the other lamas. We could not come, Holy Lama, no matter how urgent our need." I thought all this was ridiculous. The Regyab or disposers of the dead, who lived in the southeast corner of Lhasa, were as essential as any in our community. I knew that because my guide was always stressing that no matter what a person did, that person was still a useful member of the community. I remember once laughing heartily when he said, "Even burglars, Lobsang, are useful people, for without burglars there would be no need of policemen, hence burglars provide policemen with employment." But these Regyab, many people looked down upon them thinking they were unclean because they dealt with the dead, cutting up dead bodies so that the vultures would eat the scattered pieces. I knew, and felt as my guide, that they did good work, for much of Lhasa was so rocky, so stony, that graves could not be dug, and even if they could, normally Tibet was so cold that the bodies would just freeze and would not decay and be absorbed into the ground. "Madame," commanded my guide, "you shall bring this child to me in person 3 days from now, and we shall do our utmost to see that he is cured, for from this brief examination it appears that he can be cured." He fumbled in his saddlebag and produced a piece of parchment. Quickly he wrote a message upon it, and handed it to the woman. "Bring that to me at the Chakpora and the attendant will see that you are admitted. I shall inform the gatekeeper that you are coming and you will have no difficulty whatever. Rest assured, we are all humans in the sight of our gods. You have nothing to fear with us." He turned and looked at the husband. "You should remain loyal to your wife." He looked at the wife and added, "You should not abuse your husband so much. Perhaps if you were kinder to him he would not go elsewhere for solace. Now, go to your home and in 3 days from now return here to the Chakpora and I will see you and assist you. That is my promise." He mounted his pony again and we rode off. Diminishing in the distance were the sounds of praises and thanks from the man of the Ragyab and his wife. "I suppose for tonight at least, Lobsang, they will be in accord. They will be feeling kindly disposed to each other." He gave a short laugh and led the way up to the road to the left just before we reached the village of Sho. I really was amazed at this, which was one of my first sights of husband and wife. "Holy Lama," I exclaimed, "I do not understand why these people came together if they do not like each other. Why should that be?" My guide smiled at me as he replied, "You are now calling me Holy Lama. Do you think you are a peasant? As for your question, well, we are going to discuss all that on the morrow. Tonight we are too busy. Tomorrow we will discuss these things and I will try to set your mind at rest, for it is sorely confused." Together we rode up the hill. I always liked to look back down on the village of Sho, and I wondered what would happen if I tossed a good-sized pebble onto a roof or two. Would it go through? Or would the clatter bring someone out thinking that the devils were dropping something on them? I had never actually dared drop a stone down because I did not want it to go through the roof and through someone inside. However, I was always sorely tempted. In the Potala we mounted the endless ladders, not stairways, ladders which were well worn and steep, and at last we reached our apartments high up above the ordinary monk, above the storehouses. The Lama Minyadon up went to his own room and I went to mine, which was adjoining. By virtue of my guide's position and by being his gila, I had been allowed this room. Now I went to the window and, as was my wont, I looked out. Below us there was some night bird calling to its mate in the willow grove. The moon was bright now, and I could see this bird, see the ripples of water as its long legs stirred up water and mud. From somewhere in the quite near distance there came the answering call of a bird. At least that husband and wife seemed to be in harmony. I thought to myself. Soon it was time to go to sleep, for I had to attend the midnight service, and already I was so tired that I thought that possibly in the morning I could oversleep. In the afternoon of the next day the Lama Minyadon up came into my room while I was studying an old book. "Come in with me, Lobsang," he said. "I have just returned from a talk with the Inmost One and now we have to discuss problems which are puzzling you." He turned and led the way into his own room. Sitting in front of him, I thought of all the things which were on my mind. "Sir," I said, "why are people who marry so unfriendly to each other? I looked at the aura of those to Ragyab last night, and it seemed to me that they really hated each other. If they hated each other, why did they marry?" The Lama looked really sad for a few moments, and then he said, "People forget, Lobsang, that they come down to this earth in order to learn lessons. Before a person is born, while a person is still on the other side of life, arrangements are going ahead deciding what sort, what type, of marriage partner will be chosen. You should understand that a lot of people get married in what one might term the heat of passion. When passion spends itself, then the newness, the strangeness, wears off and familiarity breeds contempt. Familiarity breeds contempt." I thought about it and thought about it. Why, then, did people get married? Obviously people got married in order that the race might continue. But why could not people get together the same as animals did? I raised my head and asked that question of my guide. He looked at me and said, "Why, Lobsang? You surprise me. You should know as well as anyone that the so-called animals often mate for life. Many animals mate for life, many birds mate for life, certainly the more evolved ones do. If people got together, as you say, just for the purpose of increasing the race, then the resulting children would be almost soulless people, the same in fact as those creatures who are born by what is known as artificial insemination. There must be love and intercourse, there must be love between the parents if the best type of child is to be born, otherwise it is much the same as just a factory-made article." This business of husband and wife really puzzled me. I thought of my own parents. My mother had been a domineering woman, and my father had been really harsh to us, his children. I could not summon up much filial affection when I thought of either my mother or my father. I said to my guide, "But why do people get married in the heat of passion? Why do they not get married as a business proposition?" "Lobsang," said my guide, that is often the way of the Chinese and of the Japanese too. Their marriages are often arranged, and I must admit that Chinese and Japanese marriages are far, far more successful than marriages in the Western world. The Chinese themselves liken it to a kettle. They do not marry in passion because they say it is like a kettle boiling and cooling off. They marry coolly and allow the mythical kettle to come up to the boil, and in that way it stays hot longer. He looked at me to see if I was following, to see if the matter was clear to me. But I cannot see, sir, why people are so unhappy together. Lobsang, people come to earth as to a classroom, they come to learn things, and if the average husband and wife were ideally happy together then they would not learn, for there would be nothing to learn. They come to this earth to be together and to get on together, that is part of the lesson. They have to learn to give and to take. People have rough edges, edges or idiosyncrasies which jar and grate on the other partner. The grating partner must learn to subdue and perhaps end the annoying trait, while the partner who is annoyed must learn tolerance and forbearance. Almost any couple could live together successfully provided they learned this matter of give and take. Sir, I said, how would husband and wife be advised to live together? Husband and wife, Lobsang, should wait for a favorable moment, and should then kindly, courteously, and calmly say what is causing them distress. If a husband and a wife would discuss things together, then they would be more happy in their marriage. I thought about this, and I wondered how my father and my mother would get on if they tried to discuss anything together. To me they seemed to be fire and water, with each one being as antipathetic to the other. My guide obviously knew what I was thinking, for he continued, "There must be some give and take, because if these people are going to learn anything at all, then they should be sufficiently aware to know that there is something wrong with them." "But how is it," I asked, "that one person falls in love with another, or feels attracted to another? If they are attracted to each other at one stage, why do they so soon cool off?" Lobsang, you will well know that if one sees the aura one can tell about another person. The average person does not see the aura, but instead many people have a feeling. They can say that they like this person, or that they dislike that person. Most times they cannot say why they like or dislike, but they will agree that one person pleases them and another person displeases them. "Well, sir," I exclaimed, "how can they suddenly like a person and then suddenly dislike a person?" "When people are at a certain stage, when they feel that they are in love, their vibrations are increased, and it may well be that when these two people, some man and some woman, have heightened vibrations, they would be compatible. Unfortunately, they do not always let it remain heightened. The wife will become dowdy, perhaps she will refuse the husband what is undeniably his right. The husband will then go out after some other woman, and gradually they will drift apart. Gradually their etheric vibrations will alter so that they are no longer compatible, so that they are completely antipathetic." Yes, I could see that, and it really did explain much. But now I return to the attack. "Sir, I am most puzzled to know why a baby should live for perhaps a month and then die. What chance does that baby have of learning or paying back karma? It seems just a waste to everyone so far as I can see." The Lama Minyadon Up smiled slightly at my vehemence. "No, Lobsang, nothing is wasted. You are being confused in your mind. You are assuming that a person lives for one life only. Let us take an example." He looked at me and then looked out of the window for a moment. I could see that he was thinking of those people of the Rayyab, thinking perhaps of their baby. "I want you to imagine that you are accompanying a person who is getting through a series of lives," said my guide. "The person has done rather badly in one life, and in later years that person decides that he cannot go on any longer. He decides that conditions are just too bad for him, so he puts an end to his life, he commits suicide. The person therefore died before he should have died. Every person is destined to live for a certain number of years, days and hours. It is all arranged before they come down to this earth. If a person terminates his own life perhaps 12 months before he would normally have died, then he has to come back and serve the additional 12 months. I looked at him and visualized some of the remarkable possibilities which could come from that. My guide continued, "A person ends his life. He remains in the astral world until an opportunity occurs whereby he can come down to Earth again under appropriate conditions and live out the time he has to serve on Earth. This man with 12 months, well, he may come down and be a sickly baby, and he will die while he is still a baby.